But by the time we've reached this moment of the death of God, we already have a strange change in the discourse. What new games, new festivals, what could be invented now to make up for what has already been destroyed? What myths could we construct ourselves? What games? What holy festivals? What interesting books, fascinating arguments, and new ways to live, other than the pathetic, tragic, stupid, banal array of ordinary, everyday, bourgeois, stinking life? Surely, we can do better than that.
Hello, and welcome to the 198th episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. The guest this week is the author and radical Mark Fisher. Mark and I discuss his recent essay for the North Star blog called Exiting the Vampire Castle. The essay takes on the politically correct reaction to the comedian Russell Brand's recent call for revolution. Many leftists were perhaps overly skeptical of Brand, focusing on gaffes and slips rather than the content of his message. Brand admits to calling women birds, for instance. Fisher's essay has caused quite an uproar, especially at the North Star blog itself. There have been 6 essays written in response, and there has been a split, causing some editors to resign in solidarity with Brand and Fisher. My perspective, as always, is that Fisher isn't Marxist enough, or doesn't focus squarely on the way working people are exploited, but instead describes class on the level of appearance only. Otherwise, I find myself agreeing with Fisher. It's Thursday, December 5th, 2013, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening to the podcast and communicating with me on Facebook, on Twitter, and through my blog, that's douglaslane.com, and Lane is spelled L-A-I-N. Also, I want to thank Andrew Marshall, Jason P., and Michael P. for their one-time donations, and thank Andrew Marshall again, Ted F., John L., and Jacob L. for their continual monthly support. The music you're listening to right now is Beethoven's Ode to Joy. In just a moment, you'll be listening to Mark Fisher and I discuss the joy beyond identity. Mark Fisher is a respected music writer and a theorist. He writes regularly for Freeze, New Statesman, Sight and Sound, and The Wire, and maintains a blog on cultural theory called K-Punk. Most recently, he contributed to the North Star blog, which I've written for as well. His essay, Exiting the Vampire Castle, caused quite a stir, and that's the essay we're going to primarily talk about today. So, Mark, thanks a lot for coming on Diet Soap.
Thank you for inviting me, Doug.
Your essay did cause quite a stir. It even caused, I've heard, a split at the North Star. Did you anticipate that you'd get a big reaction from this essay in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think writing something like that, you can only anticipate quite a big reaction. And, you know, it duly arrived. I mean, part of the intention, I think, was to cause splitting. Because, frankly, I think we've wasted too much energy on kind of what I call libidinal discursive formations that are sort of damaging and toxic, and it's time to be rid of them. I think it's time to make a clear line of distinction between, I think on the one hand, communists, socialists, and social democrats who have in the past formed useful alliances which have achieved things, and on the other hand, what I call like Stalinist liberalism, I think, which has become particularly kind of vicious on the internet and on Twitter, with, you know, call out culture and a kind of savage attacks on individuals. Does that which I think we should really have a firm line of demarcation between sort of, you know, those from the Marxist tradition and that. And on the other hand, there's what I called in the essay neo-anarchism, which is defined by, I'd say, a certain kind of equivocation, really. This is particularly strong amongst young left-identifying people in the UK, I think, and coming out of the student protests of 2010, in particular. I mean, what defines it? Well, why I say it's equivocal is because, on the one hand, it's defined by a kind of antipathy towards parliamentary process. That's what makes it sort of anarchist. On the other hand, it's still engaged in a kind of, well, it's still involved in some kind of engagement with its parliamentary processes, but only at the level of kind of protest. This seems to me an incoherent position, ultimately. Why, if it's okay to protest against parliamentary decisions, isn't it okay to be in parliament in the first place? It seems to me ultimately, and whilst, you know, the essay probably reads quite as if it's quite harsh towards that position, I'm actually quite sympathetic towards it. I think it's, one can understand why people get into that position. But I think rather than it being a break from the dominant conditions of what I call capitalist realism, i.e. the idea that there's no alternative to capitalism, rather than it being a break from that, I think ultimately it's still an expression of a kind of fatalist acquiescence in that kind of worldview, ultimately. And the aim of the essay then was to identify and kind of analyze really the key features of these two libidinal formations. And as I say, to draw a line and say, we don't subscribe to this, and we want to break free of it. Because I think I think part of the issue, and particularly in the UK, I think, much more than in the US, at least that's my impression, is this kind of conflation of all these positions, partly as a result of the internet and Twitter, whereby, you know, one can't occupy any kind of space without it quickly becoming invaded by what I call sort of moralizing identitarians, who will often come in, divert the discussion. And even if they're not actually there, and this is the thing that this is what really motivated me to write this thing, I think, even if they're not actually attacking you, the fear that they might attack you is enough to cause a kind of self-censorship. Well, I'd found that, increasingly you're following a lot of notionally left-wing people on Twitter, and being on Twitter was just an increasingly depressing experience. I found sort of my energy depleted, a sense of kind of hopelessness, and also fear. Lots of things that I didn't really agree with. Well, not only didn't agree with, I thought were actually horrific, were going on. But I didn't dare really speak up against them, because I feared that if I did speak up against them, then I would attract the attention of the witch hunt to me. And, for some reason, for some reason it's obvious why one would maintain silence in those conditions. But, you know, it's not acceptable to live in fear, really. It's not acceptable to engage in self-censorship, out of the base motive of fear, really. And, I had to make a decision, really, whether I had to withdraw from writing about politics altogether because the conditions were so bad for doing it, or actually make a break with these positions, identify them, and, you know, ask people to make a decision about what side of the fence they wanted to be on, and, you know, and really then force, as I say, this split, and, you know, allow people actually to disarticulate themselves from these other kind of positions. That's what it was. It was a form of externalization for myself that I don't want. Now, I don't want to be involved with these positions anymore in any way. I don't want to engage with them. I want to disengage from them, really.
Well, I'm kind of split here as to what to ask you next, and I do want to jump in. On the one hand, I mean, I've got some prepared questions, and I want to let people who are listening kind of get a really good sense of what your essay was before they read it, if they haven't read it yet, or to think about it again. So I want to talk about Russell Brand, but I also want to, before I do that, and maybe I'll edit this out, I don't know, just kind of speak to what you're just now talking about, which is this feeling that there's kind of been there's a Stalinist, liberal, identitarian clique online, and that you're always kind of self-censoring because you are concerned you'll be the next victim of the witch hunt. Now, I can't say that I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I've seen this take place, I think. But at the same time, it seems to me, I don't know how useful it is to use words like witch hunt or even identitarian, because it seems like when you speak that way, you almost empower the kinds of critics that you're speaking to, that it becomes easier to attack you. And I'm just afraid, like, you know.
Well, I mean, I sort of lost the fear now. Like, quite honestly, I feel much happier having written it and having drawn out all the attacks than I did beforehand, because the fear of the attacks is worse than actually being attacked, because once they've slung their arsenal of, you know, fascist, racist, rape apologies, whatever they say, once they've actually slung it, then what? There's not a lot more they can do, you know. I mean, and so. I think, I mean, I can understand what you're saying, but frankly, I think it is better to identify the tendencies, and then you know, people can decide whether such tendencies do exist or not, and if they do, you know, what relationship they want to have with those tendencies. I don't think there's a question of empowering them, because they're already substantially, you know, very empowered. But I mean, I think one has to be careful about this, because I think their direct influence on a world that isn't already left identified is extremely minimal. Partly what drove me to this was not attacks they made on me, because I've in a way self-censored sufficiently to avoid these attacks previously, and also whenever there's a threat of such attacks, you know, I'd kind of withdrawn rather than confronted them. It's not so much me, but it's the attacks on people like Owen Jones. Owen, you know, has really, you know, almost single-handedly pulled the kind of center ground of the mainstream media in the UK, you know, to the left. But a lot of his energy is spent defending himself against these two positions that I've identified. If you look at his at on Twitter, you know, that Owen has immense patience dealing with these factions, and it is relentless and it is endless. And, you know, you kind of think, this isn't a good use of his energy. And I think we see part of the issue is that to me, the asymmetrical attachments, like these other two positions, the neo-anarchist position and the identitarian moralizing position, really exist in this parasitic relation, I think, to a sort of communist or socialist position. The neo-anarchists seemed only to exist in order to criticize people who still believe in that there's some merit in a parliamentary process. Not that anyone is naive enough to think that Parliament on its own, in the current conditions, can solve anything. But even to make the mild claim that there might be some hope at some point of sort of revivifying mainstream parliamentary politics, that's already enough to earn this kind of relentless harassing from neo-anarchists. So the thing is that it's. If it was the case that one could simply step away from these factions, simply avoid them, then fine, there'd be no need to identify them. But as I said, even if one isn't actually confronting them, then one is likely to be self-censoring in order to avoid that confrontation. If one is engaging in certain spheres.
For me personally, the identitarian in the United States, the identitarian position is the one that I see most often. When I put up a link to your essay, "Exiting the Vampire Castle," I got a couple of responses that I would classify and as coming from that position, from the identitarian position. And I just thought I'd read you one of them and then ask a question. So here's one of them. It says, somebody writes, "Honestly, I'm tired of hearing straight white male dude bro leftists, brochless and manarchists, bellyaching about when they're asked to care about the persecution of blacks, Latinos, Asians, women, and gays." So that's what you get.
Yes, I mean, it's an absurd, like, the thing about most of these kind of hysterical defensive responses is the way in which they've clearly not engaged with what I said in the piece. Now, there's absolutely no sense in the piece that I don't take those forms of subjugation extremely seriously. The issue with identitarianism is not, my problem with identitarianism is not that I'm saying, that racism doesn't exist, that we should ignore it, that sexism doesn't exist, that we should ignore it. That's crazy. That's a crazy position. And I don't really know, I don't know anyone on the left, even on the paleo left, who would make that claim anymore. It's just a postmodern, the thing about identitarianism now is this is a weird form of postmodern automatism, as if the last 30 years haven't happened. You know, even right wingers now, can't publicly come out and say that they're racist. Even right wingers are going to present themselves as not racist. The idea that racism is wrong is practically universally accepted now. And, that's good. That's an achievement. That's an achievement. That's actually one of the few achievements probably the left has had over the last 30 years is getting it to the stage where, sexism, racism, homophobia aren't acceptable and aren't seen to be acceptable. These are good victories, but, but in lots of ways, they have been won at a discursive level. That doesn't mean that homophobia, sexism and racism have been eliminated or anything like that. But that's part of the issue. I think part of the issue with identitarianism is that, whilst it is in lots of ways hegemonic on the left, it isn't really now achieving any real gains in terms of, reducing, for instance, women are still paid a lot less than men. The situation of non-whites is still, in lots of ways substantially worse than whites. So what's left? It seems to me that that there's a kind of helplessness or hopelessness or fatalism again in identitarianism, where its capacity to actually affect things in terms of actual social relations is pretty low now. So instead of that, what you get is this kind of attacking of individuals, and this is what I mean about why it's a Stalinist liberalism, because its focus is not on structures, not on the racist structure of society, or not on the structures that give rise to racism, not on the not on the structures that give rise to sexism, but on individuals, as if the problem were the behaviour of individuals, and as if this could be tackled by targeting individuals and kind of hounding them. I just think that's obviously wrong.
So here's a question. I agree with you. I think that's obvious that's wrong. I think even if you pushed someone who has an identitarian position, they would agree with you that's wrong. But then somehow there's power behind these attacks, despite the fact that there's this flaw. It's like, yeah, I agree with you, they'll say, and then they'll go on to critique individual by individual. I write science fiction and fantasy stuff. So what I see a lot in science fiction fandom is critiques of the way individual women are depicted on individual programs. And And I sometimes will say, well, what we need is a critique of the genre. You know, like, what are these stories telling us overall? What's the, you got to look at every piece of it. And that, they'll say, yeah. And then the next thing is, you know, this character should have been stronger, or this character should have been weaker. And what I've noticed is it doesn't really matter how a woman, say, is depicted in a show. There's always an identitarian critique of it that you can use. But it doesn't do anything.
No, that would be one of my objections to identitarianism. It doesn't do anything. Of course, it won't do anything, because one of my slogans is institutional liberalism obfuscates institutional racism or institutional sexism. You know, because of course, if you look at the problem with the individual kind of utterances or individual humans, then you'll never get to what the underlying cause of these particular manifestations is. And, you know, and that, and again, I think, you know, the sympathetic reading of this will be that it's, you know, it's a form of fatalism, you know, that people want to do something, and the structures seem so invariant, you know, that the dominant culture in the US and the UK, I think, seems now so so conservative, and the power of corporate culture seems, you know, so inviolable that what can people get at? Well, people can get at individuals, and and they've got a new capacity to do that via things like Twitter, I suppose. So, you know, I can understand why people do this, and why people think it's a good thing. I don't think, you know, I don't want to indulge them in that, in that feeling, in that conviction, even though, as I say, I can see how it's easy to be persuaded that it's a good thing to do.
Exploiting the environment, I think they should be. I think the very concept of profit should be hugely reduced. David Cameron says profit isn't a dirty word. I say profit is a filthy word, because wherever there is profit, there is also deficit. And this system currently doesn't address these ideas. And so why would anyone vote for it? Why would anyone be interested in it?
Who would levy these taxes?
I think we do need to, like, there needs to be a centralised administrative system, but built on...
There needs to be a government.
Well, we might maybe call it something else. Call them, like, the admin bods, right. So they don't get
ahead of themselves. And how would they be chosen?
Jeremy, don't ask me to sit here in an interview with you in a bloody hotel room and devise a global utopian system. I'm merely pointing out that
You're calling for revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm calling for change. I'm calling for genuine alternatives.
Do you see any hope?
Remember that? Yeah, totally. There's going to be a revolution. It's totally going to happen. I think I ain't got a flicker of doubt. This is the end. This is time to wake up. I remember I see you in that programme where you look at your ancestors and you saw that while your grandmother had to brass herself or got fucked over by the aristocrats who ran her gaff, you cried because you knew that it was unfair and unjust. And that was, what was that, a century ago? That's happening to people now. I just come from a woman who's been treated like that. I've just been talking to a woman today who's being treated like that. So if we can engage that feeling, instead of some moment of lachrymose sentimentality trotted out on the TV for people to pore over emotional porn, if we can engage that feeling and change things, why wouldn't we? Why is that naive? Why is that not my right because I'm an actor? I mean, I've taken the right. I don't need the right from you. I don't need the right from anybody. I'm taking it.
Okay, so let's talk about Russell Brand now.
And, sure.
Now, he had an interview with Jeremy Paxman. It went viral online. People who I know who aren't on the left were watching this and, like, sharing it with me. And he seemed to inspire a lot of just working people, people of all types who were fed up with politics as we know them and their lives as they knew them. And you know, he got a reaction. But you point out in your essay that the left just couldn't capitalize on that at all because of these two factions, the Stalinist identitarians and the neo-anarchists.
I don't know what it's like in the US. I mean, I suspect probably a bit less hostile than it was here. Now, like, I think, as I say in a piece, that everyone should be answerable for their behavior in the language that they use. So it's not like I would want to gloss over, alleged sexism of Brand. You know, I think, but I do have to say at this point, I think a lot of it has been overblown. A lot of the humor and self-mockery of Brand's remarks have been lost. And I think part of the issue with the identitarians is the sour-faced humorlessness of them. That they have the same kind of, they're weirdly like the fundamentalist in Atwood's the Handmaid's Tale. They have that kind of same kind of absolutely kind of solemn refusal to sort of look at nuance in things, actually, and that's quite frightening when that kind of humorlessness becomes attached to a kind of political position, I think, actually. But so I think, you know, it's fine to question any of us on the left about any of the attitudes that we've got, any of the things that we say. We shouldn't really believe in a private life, I don't think. We shouldn't believe in we shouldn't just say, oh, it's only a joke. If it's sexist or racist, you know, and you know, a certain level of vigilance about that is, of course, you know, legitimate. But what I objected to was the way in which, you know, for me anyway, trumped up charges of sexism became the dominant story about Brand and about this interview, and it just seemed a crazy and bizarre form of self sabotage, but by the left, in addition to everything else, to many of those of us who sort of come from working class backgrounds, found that interview profoundly moving. I mean, for a number of reasons, one of which is, seeing for years, Jeremy Paxman go unchallenged, really, slink into this. I mean, I guess one of the things that was interesting for me about the interview was the way in which the underlying logic of the system, the cynicism of the system, and the way in which Paxman himself personified that. You know, Paxman's general attitude of total disdain for any politician whatsoever. And the way in which Brand drew that out, the imminent logic of that, saying, well, look, it's you. You're saying I'm kind of cynical and disengaged, but it's you who have this attitude of cynicism and disengagement. And instead of smugly kind of sitting there with that attitude every week, why don't we actually sort of think about what that attitude means and where it's come from? I mean, I think that was to see Paxman challenged in that way, but also the class dynamics of the interview, a Brand is, as we know, largely self-educated. But, you know, he managed to run rings around Paxman. Paxman sort of flailing. He couldn't string an argument together. He was incoherent. Where there's a sense of absolute kind of intellectual overkill with Brand, and a certain kind of glee in his capacity to outwit Paxman. And I just haven't seen anything like that. I haven't seen someone from a working class background get the space to, you know, turn the tables on the kind of dominant bourgeois media. I haven't seen that, you know. I can't remember the last time I saw anything like that. I mean, I guess, you know, the the culture in which I, you know, like I grew up, the culture which I first, where I first came to consciousness of politics, that kind of thing was much more common, you know, in the wake of the 60s counterculture, in the wake of like, sort of post-punk, where there were, you know, many people from working class backgrounds who'd managed to, you know, propel themselves into positions of prominence in media and culture. You know, that kind of exchange was much more common. But there's been a massive re-embourgeoisement of the media, of the mainstream media, in the last 30 years, I think, in the UK in particular.
What does this famous ode to joy stand for? It's usually perceived as a kind of a ode to humanity as such, to the brotherhood and freedom of all people. And what strikes the eye here is the universal adaptability of this well-known melody. It can be used by political movements which are totally opposed to each other. In Nazi Germany, it was widely used to celebrate great public events. In Soviet Union, Beethoven was lionized and the Ode to Joy was performed almost as a kind of a communist song. In China, during the time of the Great Cultural Revolution, when almost all Western music was prohibited, the Ninth Symphony was accepted. It was allowed to play it as a piece of progressive bourgeois music. At the extreme right, in South Rhodesia, before it became Zimbabwe, it proclaimed independence to be able to postpone the abolishment of apartheid. There, for those couple of years of independent South Rhodesia, again, the melody of the Ode to Joy, with changed lyrics, of course, was the anthem of the country. At the opposite end, When Abimael Guzman, Presidente Gonzalo, the leader of Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, the extreme leftist guerrilla in Peru, when he was asked by a journalist which piece of music is his favorite, he claimed again Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Ode to Joy. Today, Ode to Joy is the unofficial anthem of European Union.
Have you ever watched an American detective program that's very old called Columbo?
Yeah. I love Columbo.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to write a book about Columbo. There you go.
I would like to write a book about him too, but I'll let you go first. But so Columbo is a lot like a Brand in a way, only Columbo is always deferring to the authority of the upper class, you know, murderer, and then letting them kind of hang themselves, whereas Brand just kind of goes for the jugular here in this interview. But there's this the same satisfaction of watching the working class hero kind of take down the bourgeois.
Yeah, and but I think one of the disturbing things as well in relation to this, to me anyway, was the way in which many people on the left have wanted to deny the class dynamics of it. You know, as if Brand, by being successful and having wealth, you know, could suddenly and irrevocably kind of escape his class origins. I think that shows an incredible naivety about the way in which class operates. And, you know, the fact that no one would say that about race or gender, no one would say, well, someone's become very wealthy, therefore it doesn't matter that they're black, or someone's, very successful, it doesn't matter that they're a woman. That's ludicrous to say that. Yet it seems to make sense to say that about class.
Well, I don't know. People said that about Obama, right? That he was participating in the system of power, that his blackness was really not a factor, and that we ought to look beyond it. And I kind of agreed with them sometimes. And let me just say one other thing, which is that I think class is different from other identities, because it's to really understand class and have class consciousness, you kind of come to realize it doesn't have anything to do with who your parents were, or what your accent is, or what your education level is. It's all about whether or not you're being exploited every day, what your position is in the way we produce things.
Well, I think you've got to be a bit careful about this, though, because I do think that a simple economistic style explanation of class, which a lot of Marxists appeal to, becomes a way of obfuscating the actual social reality of class, and also think it's anti-Marxist. You know, the idea, for instance, that the proletariat are those who don't own the means of production. But there's lots of just problems with that definition now, I would say, because one of which is, what is a means of production in the 21st century? It has sort of worked when the main way of exploiting people, the main way of which is to say, the main way of producing surplus value was by factories. It's just much more difficult in the 21st century, as we all know, with the endless discussions on immaterial labor, affective labor, and all the rest of it. I think that's one dimension is the whole crisis of production that really emerged and started to emerge in theory in the 70s. People like Baudrillard and Deleuze and Guattari, in different ways, that sort of raised issues around that. But I think even before we get to that problem about production and what means of production means now, there's also the issue about just economism, I think, which is, whenever Marx or Marx and Engels make sort of make a claim which sounds purely economistic, it is sort of betraying their theory, I think, which is that there is no such thing as economy, that there's really only political economy. And I think with some of the class, we confront the difficulty of actually thinking political economy because of bourgeois categories, and economy is itself the quintessential bourgeois category, you could say. And so therefore, I think a purely economistic explanation of class doesn't really grasp it. And it's partly because, you know, if we just say then that, well, you know, it's simply about relation to the means of production, then, you know, anyone who, you know, someone who wins the lottery, whatever, can step out of their class. It's true in a certain way, but the issue is the class structure, I would have thought, not individuals and their class position. And then we have to account for the class structure. That has to be a reason that some people, or the majority of the population, is able to be exploited. You know, why do the majority of the population, you know, allow themselves to be exploited? Why do the majority of the population, you know, move into a position of owning the means of production or whatever? And I think then we have to talk about, you know, subordination as an issue with class, and subordination then, you know, as a certain, you know, people experiencing themselves as inferior. And I think this is the key thing, and this is why I think class provides the key to deliberalizing race and gender, which is the same thing as denaturalizing them. I think part of the issue is, I think, and it's become really clear to me since the brand thing, I feel that the brand thing in a way sort of woke up my thinking about class, which has been slumbering, you know. And I mean, I myself would hold myself, you know, as guilty as anybody else, really, in suppressing class at the expense of kind of gender and race. You know, when I'm constructing courses, I always make sure there's plenty of stuff on gender and race on those courses. And sort of class, if it's on a lot of the courses I teach, will be this kind of apologetic half presence in lots of ways. I talk a lot about capitalism, but I don't really talk about class. I mean, so I think it's worth pushing to, well, what is the difference between class and these other forms of identity? Now, it seems clear to me now that capitalism and neoliberalism can function with versions of race and gender, that is, liberal versions of race and gender, and you know, which is ultimately about petitioning for recognition by, you know, a bourgeois authority. And also, why is that the case? Well, because gender and race can seem to be natural categories. They can seem to be biological categories, but class blatantly cannot seem to be a category of that sort. And that's, I think that's why there's an epistemic superiority of the concept of class. I think, you know, some people think when I say we need to reassert class and the reassertion of class is key, is that this, that I'm saying that suffering on account of class means, you know, is greater than other kinds of suffering, which would be ludicrous. That's not what I'm saying.
Well, I am saying it even worse than that. Sometimes people will hear, "Oh, it's the suffering of white male workers that should be dominant." You know, that's what sometimes people hear when you say
we should feature. I mean, what I'm saying is, it should feature. That's the problem. I mean, what we've got is, this is what I mean about the postmodern nature of this identitarianism. It's just an automatism, because there was a time, plainly, when these arguments had to be had. There was a time when, you know, the Marxist, you know, communist, socialist left was all about white male workers and only about that. And, you know, the idea of like there being struggles around sexism and racism, and that these being taken seriously at all, you know, was poo-pooed and regarded as absurd. But as I say, that time is long gone, and we've come to the other extreme now. We've come to the other extreme now where you can't mention class at all without people thinking that you're saying that race and gender don't matter. And that's what I explicitly said in a piece, not that race and gender don't matter, but that we ought to be able to assert class, you know, alongside race and gender. And the, as I say, the epistemic quality of the concept of class allows us to really decode or pull gender and race from their liberal articulations. You know, because a capitalism is obviously happy about those categories. It isn't happy with the concept of class. It can't really function with the concept of class. Class doesn't officially exist under capitalism. You could say the found, you know, what is it that founds capitalism? You know, the escape from feudalism, you know, is the idea that, well, we don't have this thing anymore. We don't have castes anymore. You know, everyone's place in the system is determined by, you know, their own merit. And of course, this is capitalist ideology in itself, you know,
I really love the economic understanding of class. Because when you start to understand that capitalism itself is founded on a class division, that it relies, that it cannot function without exploiting the working classes, then you start to see that classes can't be escaped, and that in order to escape all sorts of inequalities and injustices, we'll have to devise a better way of running our world, a better economy, a better political system, all of it. Based on mutual understanding or cooperation, or I'm not sure what. That's one of the things that I struggle with, is trying to figure out what would replace capitalist production. But nonetheless, if you understand the way class functions inside the economy, then, you know, the question of whether it exists or not is just not even a question anymore. And then it also fits everyone else into it. It fits people into it, or all sorts of ethnicities. It fits people who are immigrants into it, who weren't working class till they came here. It, you know, fits lots and lots of people into it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that I object to the economic dimension. I just that I think that it's insufficient in itself, because I think we have to deal with the dimension of marking an inferiority. You know, partly to explain, as it were, why revolutions don't happen, I think, or have not happened. And I actually, you know, think there's, you know, people like Fanon, actually, in some elements of post-colonial theory, may have more to offer in some ways than the traditional pure economism. And that's why I objected to the pure economism, you know, about, you know, how groups are subjugated, subordinated. And I think this concept of subordination is one that I'd really like to hold on to, and why I think that Brandt thing was significant was insubordination, but not a form of insubordination that was just fuck off, you know, it's just where a kind of stereotype of working class aggression was sort of played out, you know, a form of insubordination where that's, you know, that stereotype was played inside out because it was about intelligence, etc. But I think I'd rather talk about, rather than identity politics, I'd rather talk about subordination, forms of subordination, as it were, that what people are calling identities are forms of subordination. It's how do we overcome those forms of subordination should be the question. Because I think, and partly what influenced that piece is Foucault, this is what some people aren't getting as well in their response to it. That the critique of identitarianism, one of the most powerful critiques of identitarianism, comes from queer theory, I think, or queer theory when queer was something other than a kind of synonym for homosexual. And of course, it's Foucault's work which played a big role in that distinction. And you know, and Foucault's work as a refusal of identity, and the simple awareness that, you know, he pushed in History of Sexuality 1 in particular, that, you know, identity is something that dominant power constructs for people. That, you know, getting into a position of defending one's identity, defending the prison that identity has constructed for, you know, for people. And I think then we're back also to Nietzsche, and why it was necessary for Nietzsche to be introduced into kind of into Marxist thought. I mean, largely as a result of Foucault and then later Zatari. You know, is this idea that, you know, that one shouldn't invest in one's status as a victim, because, you know, partly because that is by its very nature self-defeating. Don't we want to overcome these positions of subordination, of subjugation? Don't we want to escape from them? We don't want to identify with them, as it were. And, you know, that, again, I think, you know, the sympathetic line on this would be that, you know, the people are forced into these forms of identification, into this kind of investment in their own status as victims because of impotence. You know, and I think a lot of the issues that I was talking about in the essay really are a consequence of leftist impotence. You know, as I say in the piece, the right are very good at showing a class consciousness, at supporting each other. You know, what we call conspiracies are really in lots of ways ruling class consciousness. You know, whereas we're very bad at it. And that's partly because they have something to defend. You know, they have actual power, whereas we have cultural power, we have power in universities, but we don't have power over, you know, everyday life. We have increasingly little power over sort of media. We have almost no power at all over the sort of government anymore. And you know, this tendency to attack one another, to hound one another, you know, is, I think, you know, a sad symptom of that kind of powerlessness, really.
And okay, so one of the things we can note about Starbucks, isn't it, is the way in which the criticisms of Starbucks, which, as I say, are often made by the people who use Starbucks. I think we should be positive about this and say, really, then, that this shows that the desire for Starbucks is the thwarted desire for communism. Really. And I'm not just being facile about it, neither.
1, 2, 3, 4.
As people have said, the desire for Starbucks is fundamentally tied up with the desire for what is called the third place, not work, not home. And so what you get in Starbucks is a degraded form of public space. If the, you know, the success of Starbucks tells us anything, then, is that the desire for public space has not withered away. You know, the question is to really go with this. If people want the generic, the homogenous, and the standardised, you know, can't we imagine much better versions of the generic, and the homogenous, and standardised than Starbucks provides, actually? And you know, you can say, look, we can get you a much better designed space than Starbucks. You pay a little bit more on your tax. You don't even, you're going for free. You don't even have to drink a rubbish coffee either.
1, 2, 3, 4.